Hi, this is Kim Claus. Oh, those Koch brothers. Oh, these continuing attacks on working people and education. Oh, those billionaires taking over our government. We've seen and felt these attacks increasingly over the last decade, and to many of us, they seem to come out of the blue. But did they really? Enter historian, Duke University professor, and author Nancy MacLean. Her latest book, Democracy in Chains, The Deep History of the Radical Right's Stealth Plan for America, is an expose that explains how we got here. Nancy will be here in Kansas City at KKFI's Kicking the Koch Habit Conference at UMKC Student Union, Saturday, August 11th. Recently, I had the pleasure to speak to Nancy about this book. Nancy MacLean, welcome to KKFI.
I'm happy to be with you.
So can you tell us how Democracy in Chains, the book, came to be?
Sure. I actually was not working on the book that it became. In the beginning, I was actually tracing the state of Virginia's reaction to the Brown versus Board of Education decision. And in 1955 and 1956, Virginia led the wider white South in what was called massive resistance to that Supreme Court decision requiring the desegregation of public schooling. And I found that free market fundamentalists, libertarians like Milton Friedman had gotten involved in that and were essentially applauding the state of Virginia for providing these tax-funded vouchers for private school education. And that really intrigued me because that's obviously a story that we didn't know about this free market project, but it seemed really important. So I started digging in, and through that process of research, I came across a figure named James McGill Buchanan, whom I had never heard of, so don't feel bad if you haven't.
I have now.
He was the first U.S. Southerner to win the Nobel Prize in Economic Sciences, which he won in 1986. And to make a long story short, I learned that it was his set of ideas, sometimes called public choice economics, sometimes called the Virginia School of Political Economy, but that Charles Koch had weaponized in order to effect this transformation of our country.
And so I think another good place for us to kind of start would be to take a look at the beliefs of the libertarians. So can you give us like a thumbnail sketch of libertarians and what they believe?
Sure. And I have to say this was, again, intriguing to me as a researcher because I really didn't know much about libertarianism. And in truth, it's a pretty marginal cause in our country, by all the polling data and such that we have, only about 2 or 3% of the population identify with libertarian ideas in any kind of consistent way. So they wouldn't be a significant group if there weren't so much money behind them. And that's where Charles Koch and this donor network he has put together really come to factor in a big way, because they have given these once incredibly marginal ideas extraordinary power to decide the future of our country. So essentially, libertarians believe that government has only three legitimate functions, that it should provide for the rule of law, for the defense, national defense from, foreign aggression and stuff, and also for social order. So as one interviewer teased me, it's essentially courts, police, and army. Right? But other than that, government shouldn't be doing anything. So all the things that citizens have come to expect government to do over the course of the 20th century, from provide for public health, to ensure retirement security, to guarantee workers' rights, to do, anti-discrimination enforcement, to protect our air and water, none of those things are legitimate from the perspective of a strict libertarian. So it is really, really a radical set of ideas, and of course a set of ideas, once I describe it, that you realize would have no chance of affecting the political process if presented honestly, in an effort to persuade the majority. It would get nowhere. And that's, I think, where my research really comes into play and is helpful in Democracy in Chains, because I learned that Charles Koch and this figure James Buchanan and other key architects of the modern radical right in the U.S. understood that they were a permanent minority, that they would never persuade people of these views, and therefore they turned to a stealth strategy in order to try to achieve their ends by first building up this enormous organizational infrastructure of groups like the Cato Institute, the Heritage Foundation, the Federalist Society, and quite literally hundreds more organizations, building up that infrastructure, developing a cadre, and they actually studied Vladimir Lenin of the Bolshevik Revolution in order to think about how to develop this cadre that would move the project. And then they have also engaged in radical rules change by stealth in order to achieve the power that they have. And so some examples of that would be suppressing political participation using the myth of voter fraud to get voter suppression legislation, engaging in the most radical gerrymander in our political history in order to keep a minority in power, minority party in power in the states where this radicalized Republican Party has control, and also pushing out systematic misinformation to the public about climate science and the need for action to protect our planet. Those are just a few examples of the kind of stealth that this cause is engaged in, but they also apply it with Social Security, you know, the effort to get Social Security privatization, you know, all these other efforts. So it's really a quite sophisticated, elaborate, long game of what Charles Koch has called interrelated plays in order to make it so that this tiny, tiny minority has been able to shape our country to an incredibly successful degree, particularly over the years since the 2010 midterm elections.
Well, and long game. That's what I kept thinking all throughout this book. Boy, you talk about your long game. I mean, and so, you know, when it was mostly James Buchanan and his friends, colleagues, not sure what to call them all, they spent, you know, decades kind of doing this stealth thing. And then kind of when Koch came in at one point, it just all kind of, it kind of exploded and got really obnoxious. And he just started going full force. And how did that happen?
So this is, you know, more than a 60-year project at this point. So I picked up the trail with Buchanan in 1956. He moved to Virginia, to Charlottesville, University of Virginia in Charlottesville, that we saw in the news last year with the horrible white supremacist mobilization there. But he set up shop as the new chair of the economics department in Charlottesville with the complete blessing of the state's white segregationist, deeply oligarchical political elite, and set out to develop a new school of political economy and social philosophy, and plan to train thinkers for for a fight that he understood would be generations long, you know, would not bear fruit for decades. And not very far into that project, by 1969-1970, at the latest, he came to know Charles Koch and Charles Koch's foundation in Wichita, which was also pushing for private education, right, and trying to build support for tax support for private schooling, and to promote a wider libertarian agenda. So they got to know each other through that process when Charles Koch began developing the Cato Institute and other libertarian endeavors, including ultimately the Federalist Society, by the way, Charles Koch provided seed money for. James Buchanan was there. He was involved. He was participating in helping to launch those efforts. And I think what actually really brought them together was Buchanan's work for the Pinochet junta, military junta in Chile that had overthrown a democratically elected socialist government of Salvador Allende and ruled by brute force, you know, killing thousands of people, torturing people. You know, it was one of the human rights horrors of the 1970s and early 1980s. And Buchanan was invited to Chile in 1980 to help them devise what they came to call the Constitution of Liberty. And this Constitution of Liberty basically was used to lock in everything that the dictatorship achieved while they had suppressed labor unions, student groups, farmers, groups, the free press, et cetera, including the privatization of Social Security and education. And Buchanan helped them craft a constitution that would make it nearly impossible, even for a two-thirds majority in a subsequent government to reverse those changes. And that actually happened in 2013. Michelle Bachelet, an elected president who had the backing of two-thirds of the Chilean people on a wide-ranging reform program, found that she couldn't deliver, that her hands were bound by this constitution that she referred to as a constitution with locks and bolts. And that story is really important for Americans to understand now, because the kind of constitution Buchanan developed in Chile is now coming to the U.S. thanks to the Charles Koch network's cultivation of this reactionary school of legal thought that we can see represented in the new Supreme Court nominee, Brett Kavanaugh. And they are also pushing for a state-convened constitutional convention, the first in our history, in order to amend the U.S. Constitution in ways that would make it impossible for the people to achieve the kind of things that popular majorities have achieved over the course of the 20th century and the first part of the 21st in the United States. So this is an incredibly radical vision. It is almost, it's mind-boggling even to consider it, that it's so audacious. It would not be possible had we not let inequality develop to the point that we have. But we have now reached that point, and this Koch network is actually close to getting enough authorizations to call a constitutional convention. So you need 34 to do it, two-thirds of the states. They now have 28 of those 34. They need six more states, and there are six Republican-controlled states that have not yet authorized a convention. So this is, you know, would be the most radical rules change that you could imagine in our history. It is coming very close, and so I believe that this is kind of an all hands on deck emergency moment and era for the future of democracy in our country, and also certainly for the health of our planet, because these guys are using up the window that we have to act on that. So I'm really excited that this conference is being held in Kansas City to deal with the Koch challenge next weekend, and I'm really looking forward to being part of those conversations. And I hope that, you know, all the people who listen to your show will attend or try to find out more about it, because it is really a vital conversation we need to be having.
Well, I'll tell you what, the chapter about Chile just about scared me to death.
Yeah,
you know, I mean, that,
say that.
Oh my goodness. I thought, oh, look at this little tangent. No, it was a little bit like watching The Handmaid's Tale, right? It felt a little bit like,
yes,
that was
exactly.
You know, yeah, somebody else's story, and you feel like you're looking into your future. I wanted to talk just a little bit about, kind of go back to education and talk a little bit about, I mean, there was Brown versus Board. I work for an AFT local, so of course, you know, my ears perked up when I, you know, started seeing Brown versus Board. But there was a whole chunk of this story that had to do with K-12 public education and,
yes,
and to deal with higher education. And Brown versus Board may have just been a catalyst for something, but why their seemingly hyper focus on education?
Yeah, that was, you know, as I came into this, you know, entered as a researcher into this world that I knew nothing about, I was really shocked to discover how deep the hostility to public education was on the right, and to public education precisely because it was public. Mm-hmm. And I think that's very important for Americans to understand. You know, in the 1950s, when my story starts, America led the world in the quality of its public education system. You know, our schools were the envy of the world. They were doing, you know, extraordinary work. And yet the right hated those public schools, even at that time, again, because they were public. So it's hard to wrap your mind around, because, again, it's such a kind of a fringe belief, you know, a fringe,
right,
fringe ideology.
Right.
But they don't like anything that's public, right? Public education, no social insurance, no public buildings, no public lands, you know, no national parks, like all of these things they would like to see privatized, right? And they would like to have user fees, private owners, et cetera. And so as I got into this project, it was more of a schools project, and I was fascinated to learn that the right had really been turning against public education, particularly since the 1930s with the New Deal. And they actually couldn't believe that, like, most Americans wanted to have things like workers' rights, Social Security, labor standards, et cetera. So they thought it must be communists. You know, communists have taken over our public education system, that our children would be coming home and telling us they support, you know, workers' right to organize and, you know, like, you know, 40-hour work week and minimum wages and so forth and so on. So it kind of started from that almost paranoiac anti-communism and then became this just enmity toward anything that was public. And so that's what really carried through. And just to give you an example of this, when I was doing the earlier phase of the research for this and looking at Milton Friedman, the University of Chicago economist, he said over and over again in his papers that he believe that there should be no such thing as public schools, which he called government schools, right?
Right.
And he said not only should ultimately in the libertarian, you know, utopia dream world, not only would there be no so-called government schools, but also there would be no public funding for education. He said over and over again that schooling, that parents should pay for their children's schooling like they pay for their food and their shelter, except he'd say if for a few charity cases. So imagine a world in which this notion of personal responsibility is taken to the point that every parent has to pay, you know, to choose private schools for their children and to pay for that schooling out of pocket, while also, if this cause wins, having to save for their health care, their private health care account, for their private retirement account, for their private uninsurance account. And where would those private accounts be invested in this privatized world? With an unregulated financial sector, an unregulated Wall Street, because this cause also doesn't believe in regulation. So that is the kind of world that this Koch-led cause is trying to bring into being. And I just think Americans do not understand how radical this is, do not understand what the end game is, and have not been able, you know, understandably, because these guys are kind of hiding a lot of what they do, and as I said, operating by stealth, but aren't able, therefore, to see the connections between the various pieces of this project. So that's really what I was trying to convey in Democracy in Chains, through telling the story of Buchanan and then a Koch's discovery of his ideas and weaponizing of them, that how these guys are trying through their various operations to transform our country without ever being open and honest with the American people about the actual world they're trying to bring into being, or what they are willing to use in order to bring that world into being. So it's really chilling stuff. And I have to say it's also quite ugly because, again, this is a profoundly minority cause, right? You know, like not even 10%, not, you know, like much less than a half of 10% of the population agrees with them, and they know it. And therefore, in order to get power to move this agenda, they have had to misrepresent themselves as conservatives, for example, actually.
Right.
They used to condemn conservatives in no uncertain terms, in really contemptuous terms, to use the religious right, even though many of these people are atheists, right, and were deeply anti-clerical, but they're using ignorant, you know, people's lack of knowledge about them, and also prejudice in order to move their ball down the field. And so what we've seen, particularly under the Trump presidency, but even before that with the voter suppression efforts and such, is the strategic use of racism in order to make white people feel afraid, feel threatened, feel angry, and feel willing to go to the polls and pull the lever for candidates who are hurting them, who are not being honest with them. And we see that most dramatically now with the immigration issue and the ways that the Trump administration and, frankly, its allies in the Koch network are using those prejudices to turn out their base. And so we have really significant work to do, I think, in terms of alerting people to what the actual project of this Koch-led cause is, to the way in which the Trump administration is pushing through the Koch agenda with more rapidity than it has ever gone through before, whatever noise they're making in the press this week about one another, and to the fact that they are seeking the radical transformation of our legal and political system in a way that would put shackles on the people's ability to organize, to resist this agenda, or to change our country back again once they see what these folks are creating. So it's, you know, I really do believe the next, you know, year to 3 years are going to be absolutely critical and decisive for our long-term future.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Nancy McLean, I can't believe it. Our time is already up. It went so fast. I really loved
it. It was great talking with you.
Oh, it was. And I really loved your book, Democracy in Chains. And we will see you next weekend in Kansas City at the conference.
Sounds wonderful. I'll see you then.
Thanks.
Thank you.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Nancy McLean, PhD, is a Trinity College of Arts and Sciences professor of history at Duke University. Her other books are Behind the Chivalry, The Making of the Second Ku Klux Klan, and Freedom is Not Enough, The Opening of the American Workplace. I want to mention once again that she will be in Kansas City at KKFI's Kicking the Koch Habit Conference at the UMKC Student Union on Saturday, August 11th. For more information, go to kkfi.org/conference. Hope to see you there.